Another piece of the Russia puzzle today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Big statement today by Jared Kushner on Russia.
Let me be very clear. I did not collude with Russia, nor do I know of anyone else in the campaign who did so.
But there's more to the Trump-Russia story. We focus on a lesser-known part of it, how ExxonMobil violated U.S. sanctions on Moscow under Rex Tillerson, then Exxon CEO, now Trump Secretary of State.
It's not entirely clear how aware he was. These were Exxon subsidiaries that were signing these deals, but he's the person who ultimately is responsible as chief executive.
Plus, British poet Ben Okri was shaken by the Grenfell Tower apartment block fire in London. We'll hear part of the poem he wrote in response to the tragedy. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Glad you could be with us on this Monday. Considering he's one of the president's closest advisors, it's a pretty good bet you've never heard his voice.
My name is Jared Kushner. I am senior advisor to President Donald J. Trump.
Today, we heard his voice, and he had something he wanted to say.
Let me be very clear. I did not collude with Russia, nor do I know of anyone else in the campaign who did so. I had no improper contacts. I have not relied on Russian funds for my businesses. And I have been fully transparent in providing all requested information.
Jared Kushner there outside the White House today after speaking at a closed-door hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee. He's got a date with the House Committee tomorrow. The committees want to hear from him precisely because Kushner has not been so clear about his meetings with Russian officials. Two other members of the Trump campaign are also giving testimony this week. We're going to be following that story as it unfolds, but today we're zeroing in on another story that involves Russia and a member of the Trump administration. Before Rex Tillerson became Secretary of State, he was head of ExxonMobil. And last week, the Treasury Department fined ExxonMobil for violating U.S. economic sanctions against Russia with, quote, reckless disregard. The fine is $2 million, chump change for the oil giant. But now ExxonMobil is suing Treasury and the current Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, over the issue. Imagine the cabinet meetings with Trump, Mnuchin, and Tillerson as they talk about all this. Alan Rappaport is on the story for The New York Times.
So this goes back a couple of years. Exxon, back in 2014, signed a contract to do some deals with Rosneft, the Russian state oil company. And they've had an ongoing relationship with the company for a long time. But this is around the same time that the United States imposed sanctions on Russia for its incursion into Crimea and into Ukraine. So this was, you know, according to the United States government, this is a violation of those sanctions. And there had been a lot of back and forth between, you know, Exxon and the Treasury Department over the last couple of years. But now, you know, it's finally cut, you know, it's come to sort of the fruition that there's a $2 million penalty and that this was a violation because Igor Seshin, who's the CEO of Rosneft, was the person who signed those contracts and he was on the blacklist from the sanctions.
Right. And just remind us who Igor Seshin is, because he's pretty powerful in Russia, right?
Yeah, very powerful. You know, he's been there for a long time. He's been, you know, watched by the U.S. government for a long time, very close to Putin. So he's been somebody that, you know, it was definitely a big blow when he was put on the Treasury blacklist. And it sort of raises the question, you know, are they actually putting a sanction on Rosneft, which would be a much bigger deal, or is it just this individual? So Exxon's point of view was that because it was him specifically that was sanctioned, they could still continue their ongoing business with Rosneft. But now the Treasury Department seems to be seeing it differently.
Rex Tillerson was CEO of ExxonMobil when all this went down in 2014. Was this something he was involved in personally or aware of?
You know, it's not entirely clear how aware he was. These were Exxon subsidiaries that were signing these deals, but he's the person who ultimately is responsible as chief executive. Now, he's recused himself from all Exxon business, so, you know, I'm sure he's followed the news, but, you know, we don't know whether or not he had any input into what was going on with these sanctions, presumably not because of the recusal.
Yeah, as CEO of ExxonMobil, Tillerson spoke out strongly against sanctions on Russia. Where does he stand today as Secretary of State?
Exactly. He was against the sanctions as CEO of Exxon. As Secretary of State, he's expressed concern about, you know, the idea of ratcheting up sanctions, which Congress wants to do. But at the same time, you know, he wants to have more negotiating power, as does the rest of the Trump administration, President Trump, to be able to lift sanctions if necessary. But he's also, you know, taken a tough tone with Russia. He said, you know, early on that Russia-U.S. relations were an all-time low. But I think, you know, he and the rest of the administration want to have the flexibility to ease sanctions, you know, if possible, as part of a larger deal.
Has Tillerson spoken about this $2 million fine from the Treasury Department and the lawsuit from his former company?
He has not. The State Department and Tillerson have referred all questions on this to Exxon, and you know it appears that they're trying to stay out of it, at least on the surface.
How do you think this whole episode fits into larger concerns about conflicts of interest in the Trump White House?
Well, I mean, I think it goes to show you, you know, when you're bringing people in from the business world, they have, you know, long histories of doing business, particularly Tillerson, very well known in Russia. And this is just another example of how these are playing out, you know, as these policy debates play out. So, you know, we've seen it with the Treasury Secretary, too. People ask questions about, you know, how somebody from Goldman Sachs is supposed to be, you know, crafting tax reform and not have conflicts of interests, you know, when dealing with global banks and his own bank. So we're seeing that sort of across the administration as they bring in many people from industry.
Alan Rappaport of The New York Times, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
When Nigerian novelist and poet Ben Okri published The Famished Road in 1991, he became the youngest recipient of the Booker Prize for Fiction. As a resident in the UK, his eye is trained on both his backyard and the Nigerian and larger African diaspora, so he sees a lot. But it was a vision of an apartment block going up in flames that has shaken him, like few other events he's witnessed since living in the UK, and it triggered a poem. You may have seen Okri reading Grenfell Tower, June 2017, online, and its repeating line, "If you want to see how the poor die, come see Grenfell Tower, see the tower, and let a world-changing dream flower." Ben Okri joins me from our BBC studio in central London. So fair to say that the inferno that was Grenfell Tower had an impact on you that few other things have had in recent years?
Yes, not just me alone. I think it affected a lot of people and continues to affect a lot of people in this country and all around the world. It's become a symbol of our time. It's just one of those things that is horrible to witness, profoundly upsetting to contemplate, and even more difficult to live with in terms of its consequences and implications.
Did you personally know anybody in the building? Had you visited there before the fire?
I knew the tower. It was a kind of in the area where I sort of lived for many years when I was learning to write. And I know many people who lived in that area and who had relations who lived in the tower. The thing about Grenfell is that it's quite representative as well, because it wasn't just one kind of person that lived in Grenfell Tower. It had people from all over the world. So it actually became, in a way, a world tragedy.
There's been this huge anger, understandably, from the community about the way the fire and the follow-up investigation have been handled. Why is that?
Oh, there's so many things. I mean, the facts keep coming out, and I don't want to prejudge any of the findings that have been painstakingly undertaken. But the very fact remains that what you have here, more than a 22-story tower block, more than 300 residents. We don't know the final number of how many people were there on the day. But the astonishing thing is that there were no sprinklers, no ways of getting people out of the building, nothing actually to contain a fire. It's the facts like that. That's deeply upsetting. The fact of the fire and the fact of the silence about so many things that people want to find out about, the treatment of survivors, the way they're scattered about the place. There's just so many things that's upsetting, that continues to upset people.
And now I read some 600 buildings across the UK are found to have the same risky exterior cladding. Are most of them council flats or public housing, as we call it here in the States?
Most of them are public housing. And it's taken Grenfell Tower to reveal the enormous fact of this hovering tragedy this tragedy that's hovering over many people's lives. It is actually quite scary.
So what message did the poorer classes in the UK hear when they learned that in the buildings they occupy, the construction is bad and potentially deadly? And what does that reveal about their position in British society?
It says it exactly as you said it. It doesn't need to be said any more clearly than you've said it. It just says that the lives of the poor are quite, you know, quite worthless. Actually, it just says that to be poor is to really be close to death. Actually, it says to be poor is to have your life measured on a very infinitesimal scale. It just says that life is measured according to your finances, which is a deeply unacceptable thing in the 21st century anywhere in the world.
Ben Okri, I know you've read your poem numerous times. I'm hoping you'll share with us an excerpt right now.
Yeah, it'll be, well, I was going to say it'll be a pleasure. It's not a pleasure. It's very painful to do. And I'll do my best. Okay. Grenfell Tower, June 2017. It was like a burnt matchbox in the sky. It was black and long and burnt in the sky. You saw it through the flowering stump of trees. You saw it beyond the ochre spire of the church. You saw it in the tears of those who survived. You saw it through the rage of those who survived. You saw it past the posters of those who had burnt to ashes. You saw it past the posters of those who jumped to their deaths. You saw it through the TV images of flames through windows running up the aluminium cladding. You saw it in print images of flames bursting out from the roof. You heard it in the voices loud in the street. You heard it in the cries in the air howling for justice. You heard it in the pubs, the streets, the basements, the digs. You heard it in the wailing of women and the silent scream of orphans wandering the streets. You saw it in your baby who couldn't sleep at night, spooked by the ghosts that wander the area, still trying to escape the fires that came at them black and choking. You saw it in your dreams of the dead, asking if living had no meaning, being poor in a land where the poor die in flames without warning. But when you saw it with your eyes, it seemed that what the eyes saw did not make sense, cannot make sense, will not make sense. You saw it there in the sky, tall and black and burnt. You counted the windows and counted the floors and saw the sickly yellow of the half-burnt cladding. And what you saw could only be seen in nightmare. Like a war zone come to the depths of a fashionable borough. Like a war zone planted here in the city. To see with the eyes that which one only sees in nightmares turns the day to night, turns the world upside down. Those who were living now are dead. Those who were breathing are from the living earth fled. If you want to see how the poor die, come see Grenfell Tower. See the tower and let a world-changing dream flower.
Nigerian novelist and poet Ben Okri reading from his poem Grenfell Tower, June 2017. British police say at least 80 people were killed in that massive fire that destroyed the Grenfell Tower apartment building in London. Mosul liberated, but awash in explosives. That story is still ahead here on The World.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom built a nationwide network of independent attorneys who can provide legal advice and answer all the day-to-day questions you have about running a small business. And since LegalZoom's not a law firm, there are never any expensive hourly fees. All pricing is given up front. For a special $10 discount, please visit LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com/world.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It took months for Iraqi forces to wrest the city of Mosul out of the hands of ISIS. It was a grueling battle that claimed tens of thousands of civilian lives, and it shattered Iraq's second largest city.
The old city now looks like just one massive bomb site. You can see the devastation and the destruction.
My BBC colleague Yalda Hakim recently visited Mosul.
And what's left now is bits of charred steel. I'm standing in front of a pile of clothing and a bag. It appears like a family was trying to take all their possessions with them, and just in the end, they couldn't. I can see a school book, a notebook just in front of me, and it, a child's drawings, and some names with hearts around them. The first person we see is Nawal. She slowly walks towards us with her family. They've come to visit her husband. He was shot dead by ISIS 2 months ago. She heard him die. She tells us they had both been taken prisoner. She tried to stay with him, but he begged her to get away to be with their children. She starts to cry. Her young daughter doesn't understand her father is dead. We drive towards the only functioning hospital in West Mosul. But suddenly, we're stopped.
The roads are now blocked into the old city, and we're being told that there was an unexploded device that they found. So the police and the military have blocked all the roads and the traffic from going in.
There was a car bomb over there. Today, we detonated it.
Is that another one?
All over this city now, Iraqi forces are working day and night to clear the areas up from unexploded devices and booby traps so that families can return to their homes. This particular unit has been working for the last 2 days to get rid of everything.
In a house a short distance away, Sunni tribesmen are gathered for a funeral.
Sheikh Mohsin al-Mahmouri says his Sunni tribe didn't support ISIS. But when the Iraqi military fled the city, they had no choice.
The Iraqi military controlled all of Mosul. But when ISIS came, they ran. We had no weapons to fight them.
He now has a stark warning for Baghdad and the world.
I blame what happened to our city on politics and the leaders. The people of Mosul remain the same. The politicians need to strike a deal. If they don't come up with an agreement, we will be victims again.
Burying the past will be harder than digging this grave in the sun-baked soil of Mosul. As this family puts to rest one of their own, the nation of Iraq labors on, fearful and weary.
The BBC's Yalda Hakim reporting there from Mosul. As you heard, much of Mosul is in ruins, and rebuilding the city is complicated by the fact that there are unexploded mines and bombs everywhere. By some estimates, it could take a decade before Mosul can be cleared. Per Lodhammer is project manager for the United Nations Mine Action Service in Iraq. He says some other cities in Iraq are also contaminated by explosives, but nothing like Mosul.
We see explosive contamination in the shape of ammunition that has been fired but has failed to function, and also ammunition that is booby traps, thousands and thousands of IEDs, improvised explosive devices, that has been placed both along long belts outside of the city, but also individual improvised explosive devices on different locations inside the city. Many of them with dual fusing systems, so with an anti-lift device and the pressure plate. So if someone steps on them, they will go off. Most of them with high explosive charges, up to 20 kilos of homemade explosives. And all of this improvised ammunition that has been manufactured in factories in the areas where Daesh have been operating.
So I know your team in the whole country of Iraq has about 40 people plus contractors, but it sounds like a complete nightmare in Mosul. How do you develop a strategy to deal with IEDs and factories and mines hidden under rubble? Where do you start?
Our priority, it's based on the United Nations Development Program and their stabilization efforts. So we basically have a list of 255 tasks for inside Mosul. All of those tasks are tasks that are critical to be renovated and to be restored, such as power plants, water treatment plants, hospitals, schools. Also that people are encouraged to return back to Mosul, and so that people also can return back because there is infrastructure in place again. I think a good example is we just cleared the Western Mosul water treatment plant. We found one improvised explosive device, we found 14 UXOs, and we have enabled contractors to restore this facility. And once it is put to operational use again, it will actually supply 500,000 people with water.
You've got 27 years doing this dangerous work. Describe what it's like going into a building where there's a strong suspicion that there are IEDs that you need to defuse.
The first step is to do survey, to visit the sites and basically look at them, see if there is explosive contamination, and then based on that, carry out clearance when needed. Most of the staff that is working doing the hands-on job, they have previous military background, so they have done it in the past. But of course, you have to expect the unexpected and be prepared for the worst, because manufactured ammunition, you know what to expect. A landmine is a landmine. Improvised explosive devices, you really have no idea what the next one is going to be like. So obviously it's something the operator needs to be focused on, and you can never get used to it. You have to wake up every day and go to work and focus, because you never know what you're going to face. And obviously there is no room for mistakes. You can't go back. If you make a mistake, it might lead to someone getting killed or someone getting injured, etc.
Yeah, I think about places like Cambodia or Mozambique, where years after conflicts have ended, kids go out to play in the field and they get blown up by a mine that wasn't discovered. And you say it could take 10 years to clear Mosul of its mines and explosives, but how long will it take before people can return to their homes there?
So it's all about getting the infrastructure in place again so that people can return. Sometimes it's not even a question of clearing ammunition, but just going to a location where there is suspected ammunition and confirm that there is nothing, as we've done in many cases. And that is also an enabling factor. Yes, that we have been there, we've done a survey, we confirmed there's no explosive hazards, and people can return or contractors can repair the facility. And I think when we say 10 years, yes, that is true. But if we look at Germany, we look at the United Kingdom, there is still contamination from Second World War. And that is certainly going to be the case in Iraq also for many years to come after the 10 years. I mean, I have a military background myself. I worked in a number of countries previously with similar problems. But I personally have never seen anything like Iraq when it comes to the density of contamination and the types of different improvised explosive devices that we see.
Per Lodhammer, project manager of the United Nations Mine Action Service in Iraq. Thank you very much for telling us about this.
Thank you very much.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple. Jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Members of a native tribe that straddles the U.S. and Canada traveled to a lacrosse tournament in Britain recently, and the fact that they used their own tribal passports made headlines.
You know, we really want to represent and be recognized for who we are as people. It's not a political thing.
That story is still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If there's one word that explains why some people leave home to go to another country, it could be the word desperation. How else to explain why you'd get on a rickety raft to cross the Mediterranean, or allow yourself to get packed into a tractor trailer in the middle of summer and let a stranger shuttle you across the U.S.-Mexico border? Yesterday, a tractor trailer was discovered in a Walmart parking lot in San Antonio, Texas. It had been packed with as many as 90 people. With temperatures over 100 degrees this weekend, the trailer became a virtual oven. 10 people died and dozens more were hospitalized. The driver has been charged with illegally transporting dozens of people across the border. Amy Fisher is with Raices, a nonprofit that provides legal services to immigrants in Central Texas. She says this kind of tragedy has happened before, though it's not common.
What is common are stories of migrants and asylum seekers really taking extraordinary risks to come to the United States to seek refuge. And that's the part of the story that is not uncommon.
Right. And often in the hands of human smugglers like coyotes.
Exactly. Exactly.
So what's going to happen to the survivors once they're released from the hospital?
I think our biggest concern is that they will unfortunately be placed in detention centers and subsequently deported. ICE has a poor track record of treating survivors of trauma appropriately. And I think our biggest fear is that they will now be subject to harsh immigration laws that criminalize people who have been victimized, who have survived trauma, who have fought tooth and nail to try and save their lives.
And I know you're in D.C., but what have you been hearing from your colleagues with Raices in Texas about how authorities in San Antonio handled this particular case?
We've seen wonderful things and things that we've been disappointed by. So I think the response from the community in San Antonio has been really beautiful. We had a few hundred people out last night at a vigil for the families. I've gotten calls and text messages, and all of us at Raices have gotten calls and text messages from folks asking how they can help. And that's really remarkable. We saw the first responders out there on Sunday morning, helping the folks, getting them to hospitals, treated for whatever they needed to be treated for. And I think we really celebrate that, right? That's beautiful. And that's what these people are supposed to be doing, the first responders. I think on the other side of things, we at Raices are condemning San Antonio Police Department for calling ICE. We understand that the Department of Homeland Security can investigate smuggling cases, but we also know that the Department of Homeland Security tends to cause more harm to immigrants than help. And so we are challenging law enforcement, especially in a state like Texas, especially in a political climate like we have now, to really think of alternatives to treating survivors as criminals, which we know the Department of Homeland Security will do.
So that's in the short term. But what can be done to address this more globally, to make this stop and not repeat these horrific deaths?
I think we have to have a larger conversation and shift the paradigm as to how we are treating the situation of immigrants and asylum seekers in the United States. We're treating the issue as a national security issue, as a border security issue, when really we need to treat it as a humanitarian issue. We need to stop equating immigrant with criminal. We need to stop militarizing our border so that people are not forced into the hands of smugglers, so that they are not forced to risk their life in order to try and save their life. That's a decision that no human being should have to make.
Amy Fisher, Policy Director of the Immigrant Rights Group, Raices, in Washington. Thanks very much, Amy.
Thank you.
Another story now on the subject of human trafficking. This is about what happens when you come to the U.S. thinking you have a good job, and then you find out when you get here that you're more like a slave. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
30 minutes outside of Washington, D.C., there is a six-bedroom townhouse with a white portico. It was the house of Jane Kabalame, a diplomat to the United States from Malawi. Her job was to advocate for Malawian citizens here in the U.S., but there was one citizen who didn't get Kabalame's help.
I mean, my life was miserable.
That's Finis Lipenga. She was Kabalame's maid, but frankly, she was more like a slave. For 3 years, Lipenga was forced to work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. She was paid less than 50 cents an hour. But it wasn't always that bad. In fact, Lipenga started working for the diplomat back in Malawi, and she says at that point, things were fine. She was a good boss.
It was like a beautiful family, first class. There was no lady flag.
Let me repeat that. She says there were no red flags. But once they arrived in the U.S., it was like everything changed overnight. Lipenga's passport was taken away from her. She was locked in the house. They would eavesdrop on her phone calls. She was forced to sleep on the basement floor. And she wasn't allowed to use the family's soap or shampoo because she was told she'd contaminate them. This was Lipenga's life for 3 years. And the whole time, Lipenga heard this refrain from her boss. I'm a diplomat. I have immunity.
She used the word immunity a lot. She told me, I can drive anywhere, I can park anywhere. I cannot get in trouble because I have immunity. I'm a diplomat.
And the worst part, this is an open secret in Washington. what happened to Lapenga happens all the time.
It's a license to traffic.
That's attorney Martina Vandenberg. She runs the Human Trafficking Pro Bono Legal Center.
Diplomats have access to a population that's highly vulnerable. The power imbalance, the class imbalance, the wealth imbalance between the domestic worker and the diplomat are enormous.
But what's more, the visa system makes it impossible for the worker to leave. Diplomats bring their domestic workers into the country on what's called an A3 visa. What that means is that the name of the employer is on the visa. So if you leave your job, you lose your right to be in the U.S. and you're out. And remember what Lapenga's boss told her?
I'm a diplomat. I have immunity.
That's a real problem, but lawyers like Martina Vandenberg have found a creative solution.
When a diplomat leaves the United States, they don't leave with their full immunity intact.
When their posting ends, their immunity shrinks to something called official acts immunity, which only protects what they do at work, their official acts.
Every court that has looked at this has determined that abusing your domestic worker, holding your domestic worker in forced labor, raping your domestic worker, not part of your official duties in the United States as a diplomat.
So lawyers wait for diplomats to leave and then sue them for compensation. This is what happened in Finis Lapenga's case. Lapenga eventually managed to escape from that house. She says one night her boss came home drunk from a party and forgot to close the garage door all the way. Lapenga slipped under the door and escaped.
I made up my mind that I couldn't take it anymore.
She fled to the home of a friend and eventually found help from a local charity. They introduced her to a lawyer who sued Jane Kambalame once the diplomat had returned to Malawi. Kambalame never responded to the summons. The court granted a default judgment and awarded Lapenga more than $1 million in damages.
And that was it.
Kambalame did eventually respond to the case against her once it came out in the press. Kambalame said she'd have to be, quote, some kind of monster to do what Lapenga was accusing her of. She went on to say that Lapenga is, quote, taking advantage of the systems in Western countries, making unsubstantiated claims about abuse and trafficking. Kambalame hasn't paid the settlement yet, and she's never been punished. In fact, she's been promoted. She's now Malawi's High Commissioner to Zimbabwe and Botswana. But Finis Lapenga isn't focusing on that. She's an advocate for victims of human trafficking and encourages others to come forward.
I mean it. I'm standing up using my voice that, yes, there's justice. I beat immunity.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Washington, D.C.
The Creator's Game, that's what the Haudenosaunee, also known as the Iroquois, call lacrosse. And they should know because the tribe invented the game. This month, the women's national team went to England to compete in the Lacrosse World Cup. And when I say national, I mean the Haudenosaunee Nation, which straddles the U.S. and Canada. The team traveled there on their tribal passports. They've tried to do that before. In 2010, the men's team had to withdraw from the World Championship in the UK because their passports were not recognized, and a women's team had to withdraw for the same reason in 2015. So just getting to play at all this time around was a triumph. And on top of that, I was told by team manager Tia Schindler, the team played well, considering the challenges.
We finished 12th out of 25 countries. It's not a bad finish. We didn't have a full roster. So, you know, by the end of the games, you know, we were feeling not having those extra substitutions. And, you know, we were also a pretty young team and a lot of people competing at the World Cup for the first time. So it was just all in all, you know, a great experience, and very proud of our girls. They left it all out on the field in England. So, yeah, we flew in yesterday and I already missed them.
And why did you not have your full roster at this tournament?
Well, it was really hard. So in 2015, we had, from top to bottom, we just had a really great team. And a lot of girls were pretty disappointed that they didn't go in 2015. And so there was a lot of people were hesitant to come back because, you know, we just really didn't know up until about a week or so before we were about to leave whether we were actually going or not.
Let's talk lacrosse for a second. Tell me a little bit about the role that lacrosse plays in Haudenosaunee life today, considering you invented it.
Oh my gosh. You know, a lot of people say lacrosse is life, and it truly is in our community. I come from a huge lacrosse family. My grandpa, Roger Smith, is in the Lacrosse Hall of Fame. My dad played, my brother played. And then me, on the women's side, I'm a third generation lacrosse player, which is pretty rare. My grandma played, my mom played, and, you know, so it's always been very accepting in our community, in my family especially. So life is dictated on who's playing where and when and what season for what team.
Wow.
When my husband and I were about to get married, it was like, okay, well, he's playing lacrosse, and what season is he? My brother's playing lacrosse. Who's coaching? Who's playing? So we end up having to get married at the Hawaii Invitational Lacrosse Tournament because everybody was going to be there.
Did everybody show up at the wedding with their sticks?
At that time. So we went in 2010, and after my husband was the captain of the Iroquois Nationals, that didn't get to go. And my brother was also on the team. A lot of cousins, boys that I babysat, were on that team. And I was with the delegation when all that happened. So my husband was absolutely devastated. And, you know, for a couple of weeks, he was really kind of in a funk. And all of a sudden he says, hey, you know, we should go to that Hawaii tournament and, you know, take the boys there and get some closure and help us, you know, heal from not being able to go, because it was, you know, like I said, it was devastating. And so he said, we should get married in Hawaii at the lacrosse tournament. So I really didn't think he was serious until the next day we were at the mall, and he said, hey, I'm going to go in here and get a suit. Huh. I said, what you need a suit for? And he said, we're going to get married in Hawaii at the lacrosse tournament. I'm like, oh, you're serious about that. So, you know, like, everything kind of happened for a reason. Our life took a different turn, and but like the utter devastation is the only way to say what happened in 2010, and then again having that upset in 2015, and having to let those girls know that we weren't going was, you know, absolutely heart wrenching. And it's not just about, you know, we really want to represent and be recognized for who we are as people. It's not a political thing. A lot of people I've heard say, oh, it's politics. It's not politics. We just really want to be recognized for who we are and be able to represent that there at the World Cup.
Why is it called the Creator's Game?
Well, I mean, lacrosse is ancient. Like, lacrosse isn't a new thing. It's an ancient thing. It began at the creation of what we call Turtle Island, what is now known as North America. So I think, like, the Creator, it is put on Earth, and it is here for his enjoyment. So anytime you're playing lacrosse, the Creator is always watching. So we believe that, you know, that the game is here and we play, and people are given their gifts of lacrosse and their talent for the Creator, for him to watch.
Tia Schindler, the manager of the Haudenosaunee national team, thanks so much for being with us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
An update now to a story we told you about last week. It had to do with a push by Poland's conservative ruling party to obtain direct control over the country's judiciary. The Law and Justice Party drafted legislation to do that and labeled it judicial reform. The move sparked large-scale protests across Poland, with demonstrators warning it could lead to an erosion of democracy. Still, the legislation passed both houses of parliament. But today, to the surprise of many, President Andrzej Duda vetoed it. Later, he went on national TV to explain why.
Poland needs a lot of justice reform, and I'm in favor of this reform. But I'm a proponent of wise reform, which will increase the sense of justice. I, as president, feel in my heart of hearts that this reform does not increase the sense of justice.
Duda was elected in 2015 as the candidate of the Conservative Law and Justice Party, and that's why nobody expected him to veto the party's reform legislation. The ruling party may still try to pass an amended version of the bill, but for now, Poland's Supreme Court justice told the BBC he welcomes the veto.
It's a very happy day. So it turned out that the state of political culture in Poland, let's say the state of attachment to the values of the rule of law, is stronger than populist and political radicalism. So it is the main reason for my joy today.
One judge's reaction to the news in Poland today. Shedding for the wedding. It's a thing, mostly for women, but if you're a young woman preparing for your wedding day in Sudan, you're probably not trying to lose weight. Many women in Sudan are turning to pills that can help them gain weight right before they tie the knot. And there can be health consequences. Yusra El-Baghir is a Sudanese journalist based in Khartoum who has investigated the trend for the BBC. So why are women trying to gain weight this way?
I think that this is seen to be a fast fix for quite a serious problem for a lot of women, and that is the intense pressure from society to marry young and marry well. There is this idea that Sudanese men love full-bodied, you know, curvaceous women, and this just seems to be the best and fastest way to get it.
Is this a long-standing ideal of beauty in Sudan, or is this something that's evolved in recent years?
Well, I'd say generally in quite a lot of indigenous African communities, you see that weight gain and being overweight is associated with prosperity and power. You've got the force-feeding camps in Mauritania, the fattening camps in Nigeria. So it's something that is quite, you know, it's already embedded in society. But then you've also got the influence of the West on the Arab world, which we kind of are at the intersection with. So we're kind of caught between the Arab world and the African world. You've got that sort of Kardashian craze happening with a lot of Arab celebrities, a lot of Lebanese singers. They're, you know, getting bio enhancement, you know, breast implants. And that also has an influence on what happens here. So we are caught in the middle. And that kind of couples up, those two phenomenons couple up and manifest themselves quite dangerously in the bodies of young Sudanese women. And it's seen as a fast fix. You know, Sudanese brides spend a month of intense beautification at home before they get married. And in that time, a lot of young women are now taking these pills as well as topical steroidal bleaching creams. And what happens is your body is severely affected by the steroid, the cortisone that's coming into your system.
It sounds like the weight gain pills could be a health risk, and then all these other things put together make it seem really hazardous.
Yeah, I mean, the weight gain pills, you know, they're appetite stimulants, which are used, but there's also the most coveted pills are the cortisone pills. They're allergy pills that have cortisone, and the side effects, which are usually deemed undesirable, are used now for desirable effect. So that's the moon face, when you have extra deposits of fat in your face that make you have a puffy face, extra deposits of fat in your stomach as well, water retention from the hormonal imbalance. And what happens is when you're taking in cortisone artificially and in high doses, your body halts its natural production of cortisone that's used to regulate your organs. So when you stop that abruptly, whether because you're married now and you want to have babies or because you can't keep it up, you've moved country or you're on your honeymoon, for whatever reason, when you stop that abruptly, your organs can dysfunction and spiral.
Wow. How easy is it to get hold of these pills in Sudan? Like, how fast do they work and how expensive are they?
Too easy, in my opinion. I mean, they're not sold in pharmacies. They're smuggled in cartel routes with prescription pills. Also, corrupt pharmacists sell them on to beauty shops, the same beauty shops that young girls go to get bleaching creams, to get beauty fixes. They ask, you know, the shop owner to bring out pills, and they'll bring out like a chocolate box filled with different pills.
They literally bring these pills out in a chocolate box?
Yeah. So that's what I've heard, that, you know, my source for the story went to her beauty shop owner to ask, and he brought it out in a chocolate box, and each little trough for the chocolate had a different type of pill.
Yusra, what is your experience dealing with the pressure of body image?
I mean, I'm quite lucky. I've had, you know, quite a privileged upbringing with, you know, living in the West, living in Sudan. But that's simply not the case for a majority of women. You know, a lot of families in Sudan, Sudan's a very conservative society. Unless you're married, you won't leave your family home for uni or otherwise. So marriage, the emphasis on marriage really heightens that sense of self-worth associated with beauty, associated with how many men want to make you your wife. And it's just very unfortunate.
My colleague at the BBC, Yusra El-Baghir, speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Thank you very much for your time, Yusra.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got a few minutes before we go today, just enough time to hear some sounds from a new group called Bukante. Bukante means exchange in the Creole spoken on the island of Guadeloupe. Exchange is a good description of Bukante itself. The band is made up of musicians from Europe, Asia, the U.S., and the Caribbean, and their sound really reflects that. West African music, Mississippi Delta blues, and Caribbean rhythms. Bukante's lead singer is Malika Tirolian. She's the Caribbean influence, again, from Guadeloupe.
I wanted to have a rhythm that is from Guadeloupe. But the fact that everybody comes from different places, that changed the rhythm a little bit and brought their rhythm into it. So it's like really a multicultural discussion and exchange, and we're all growing up from it.
And when you talk about exchange, there's also the exchange with the band's audience.
Not a lot of people know about Creole, and it kind of put Guadeloupe on the map a little bit. Well, that's what I'm hoping. And Creole is such a beautiful language.
So it was a happy surprise when Tyrolean came across a video of students in Malaysia singing one of her songs in Creole.
It's just such an example of how this language can be sung by people like so far away. It makes me feel very, very happy, very proud and very humbled, very grateful to have people from far away singing in Creole.
Caribbean singer Malika Tyrolean with the group Bukante. She was speaking with producer Sonia Narang at this year's Vancouver Jazz Festival. We leave you with another track from their new album, Strange Circles. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.